and along its long East 16th Street side, contiguous to Union Square Cafe, it has a narrow strip of a terrace that is a compelling place to sit and watch an endless parade of passers-by, not unlike a cafe on the Via Veneto in Rome. Our two restaurants shared a landlord, and I had a neighborly relationship with the outgoing restaurateur, so I was given the opportunity to take a first look. The context and location were ideal. The issue was the timing, which was off by a couple of years. Intrigued though I was, I just did not have it in me then to open a second restaurant. I still wasn't ready emotionally, nor were we prepared as a business. In 1991, I was still struggling with whether or not I would or should ever expand my company. Despite any second thoughts about having passed up that space and missing out on operating a bustling, highly profitable cafe with outdoor seating just off the park, I know I made the right decision at that time. Given our lack of managerial depth at all levels, coupled with my own ambivalence, a restaurant in that space would likely have proved problematic. And had I said yes, Gramercy Tavern would never have been born 3 years later. Metropolis Cafe was the last remaining great space adjacent to Union Square Park. That frontier had closed, but by 1996, and with Gramercy Tavern now beginning to hit its stride, I thought the timing was right for us to begin thinking about the next project. I now knew that the gestation period for one of my restaurants was often 3 years from initial idea to opening day. I had become determined to be a restaurant pioneer on Madison Square Park and to take a leading role in that park's restoration. I remember thinking that creating a restaurant overlooking Madison Square Park, desolate as it was back then, would be like flying to the moon and planting the first flag. In order to do a gut check on how much I really want to take a space or do a deal, I always ask myself whether I would do the deal if it were given to me for free. That sounds simplistic, I know, but it works. Believe it or not, my answer to that question is most often no. When Tom Colicchio and I scoured the city in 1993 in search of a location for the new restaurant we were cooking up together, which would eventually become Gramercy Tavern, we went one day to the site of the recently shuttered Coach House restaurant in Greenwich Village. We walked through the depressing space, which had once been a glorious American restaurant. It received 4 stars from Mimi Sheraton in the New York Times and was a favorite of James Beard's. Now it was musty and dank. There are few things more putrid than the stench of a dead restaurant. After touring the place, we walked across the street, looked at the building, and reflected. "I don't think I'd want that even if it were free," I said. Tom agreed, and we passed it up. Not long thereafter, Mario Batali and Joe Bastianich opened the excellent and enormously popular Babbo in that very space, creating magic within those same walls. Their guts told them that the space was right for their vision. It just wasn't right for ours. In 2004, we were invited by the hotelier Ian Schrager, then the owner of the Royalton and the Hudson Hotel in New York and the Delano in Miami, to open a restaurant as part of his very upscale renovation of the Gramercy Park Hotel. It overlooked another gorgeous park in New York, and it was a tempting opportunity. We knew we should closely examine its context, timing, and value for our company. The hotel was about as centrally and perfectly located as anything could possibly be, directly across the street from Gramercy Park, just blocks from our office, 5 of our restaurants, and from my home. Given our history of wanting to connect restaurants with parks and to be on parks, we met twice with Schrager. He lavished praise on our restaurants and discussed the generous business terms he had in mind, which I admit were impossible to ignore. I sat there thinking, this is going to be a huge lucrative business for someone. How can we not do it? Schrager, famous for having founded Studio 54 in 1977 with the late Steve Rubell, described his vision for his new hotel as a downtown version of the Pierre, a classy grand dame of a hotel that overlooks Central Park, and said he was ready to create his own enduring legacy, one that would be a perfect context for the kind of New York institution we were known to create. Still, I was wary. I want to make sure we're not putting a trendy frame on a traditional painting here, I told him. You may say you want nothing more than to have our painting hanging in your hotel, but as much as I admire your style, it's quite different from ours. You gotta trust me, he said. I've changed. No more Page Six. We're going for a low profile, for quality. This is gonna be my masterpiece. I'll even share the bar business and give you the banquet opportunities for your new catering company. Trust me, you are perfect for this. He was beginning to be convincing. By our ballpark calculations, he was handing us a potential $12 million business. I was almost willing to ignore my own gut and take a leap of faith on the context, considering how effectively he had addressed all of our other concerns. Against that temptation, I spent a week arguing with myself. This is a born-again Ian Schrager. He's no longer interested in hot places, not interested in the New York Post Page Six, not interested in paparazzi and gossip. His company has upscale hotels all over the world. He says he wants to do something of substance that will stand the test of time. That's why he's calling us. If he merely wanted to create a hot new restaurant, he could have called any number of other restaurateurs all over the world with whom he has relationships. They'd say yes in a heartbeat. The deal was favorable. We wanted to explore the strategic fit. Would there be abundant banquet space that could be served by our forthcoming new company, Hudson Yards Catering? And we wondered if the new restaurant would provide growth opportunities for any of our top staff members and, as importantly, whether or not we had enough of them to go around. Was anyone on our team ready to be promoted to chef or general manager? Looking ahead, would anyone be prepared in 30 months when the hotel was to open? Audrey had another wise question. Perhaps this restaurant was too well located. Do you really want to walk right by your restaurant every morning and night as you walk the dog and take the kids to school? You'll never get away from it. Also, Schrager's restaurant would butt up against the enormous project we had just undertaken at the Museum of Modern Art. Even though the hotel opening would be nearly 3 years away, we were so involved with the launch of our MoMA restaurants that there wasn't even enough time or mind space to dream. Saved by timing! It kept me from soul-searching over whether the context was truly right. Tempting as this offer was, we passed it up. Timing is everything. There's an important art not only to determining whether one should or should not go into a deal, but to knowing whether one might want to go into such a deal somewhere down the road. Especially in cases where timing was the decisive factor in not making a deal, there's value in remaining in close contact with the potential future partner. While it's true that today's potential business deal may later evaporate, it also may one day evolve into something bigger, better, and more richly textured. Patience has its rewards. I want to expand our company on my own terms. My unwavering long-term vision of our company is that everything else is subsidiary to context, no matter how seductive a prospective deal may appear. In the early 2000s, we were shown plans for and briefly flirted with opening a restaurant in Manhattan's enormous Time Warner Center at Columbus Circle. One fundamental issue was that a number of other elite dining establishments would also be opening there. That clustering of excellent eateries was the reason developers felt the complex would be so successful. They believed the restaurants would constitute a critical mass. But I didn't feel especially comfortable joining a collection of great restaurants in a Manhattan shopping mall, no matter how beautiful it was supposed to be. In almost every way, the opportunity at Time Warner didn't feel ideal for us. First, beyond my own personal preferences, I believe that other New Yorkers also prefer to dine out at street-level restaurants that are themselves destinations, rather than being ensconced in higher floors of a shopping center. Second, the mall itself and people's experience of going to the mall was not a frame that seemed right or would add any value for any restaurant that we might open there. And third, opening the Time Warner Center would not have marked any kind of growth or evolution in the kind of company we are. There was no true community to engage, with the possible exception of jazz at Lincoln Center, and there was no niche we could creatively fill. It was a deal I knew we didn't need. I became convinced that I was making the right decision the day I drove my daughter Hallie, who was then 8 years old, home from a weekend soccer game. In very slow traffic, we inched by the Columbus Circle site, which was then just a deep construction pit. "What would you think," I asked Hallie, "if Daddy opened a restaurant there?" She stared out the window over at the hole in the ground. "Why would you open a restaurant in there?" she asked. "Oh, it's going to be a beautiful new building," I explained. There's going to be a fancy hotel, a beautiful jazz hall, and a big TV station is going to be there too. A lot of people who like restaurants will live at the top in a really tall apartment building. There's going to be all kinds of nice shops, a grocery store, a gym, and they're going to have four or five other great restaurants there. With that, Hallie burst into tears. I never want you to have a restaurant where people are going there for some other reason than to go to your restaurant. People go to your restaurants because they want to be at your restaurant, she said. That day I added Hallie to my list of unofficial advisors. I knew she was right. It was her wise way of telling me that the context would not have been right for our company. Context, context, context. For years, I had heard the business mantra, location, 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 an ironclad principle that the key to the success of any retail establishment was picking the right address to set up shop. My own experience indicates that a far more significant contributor to success is context. A powerful example is Tiffany's famous blue box. The box is the context that provides a strong indication of what you can expect to find inside. Whatever's in that box may not be the exact gift you were anticipating, but it must be entirely consistent with your expectations of something that belongs in a Tiffany box. The box enhances the value of the object inside, and conversely, the object inside supports and further defines the meaning of the blue box. That's not about location, that's context. I had a chance not long afterward to tell Hallie about yet another venture, again at a site where thousands of people would be gathering for purposes other than for dining. But this time there would be no restaurants other than ours at the site. We would have our own entrance for our guests, and we would have a chance to add something to the dialogue on dining for people who would be visiting the site anyway. In many ways, opening the Modern and two visitor cafes at the Museum of Modern Art was the biggest gamble that I'd ever undertaken, and it was a test of my organization's core business values and competence. But if ever there was a case to be made for growing and stretching, this was it. We'd be in very new territory in terms of concept, context, and complexity. If we could pull this venture off, it would open unimaginable new doors of opportunity for our business. November 20th, 2004 was a day I'll never forget. New York's Museum of Modern Art, which to my art-loving family's way of thinking vied for interest with the Seven Wonders of the World, had closed for major renovations in 2001. Now, on this red-letter day 3 years later, it was reopening after a stunning new expansion as the art world looked on in anticipation. And our company, Union Square Hospitality Group, was part of all of this, opening not just one, but four eating establishments within the museum's complex. For us, this was not just a matter of conceiving and operating all of the food service at MoMA. It was about doing so during the high-profile relaunch of an internationally renowned institution. The degree of pressure and scrutiny I felt numbed me into a surreal sense of calm. As a businessman, I listened to two internal voices. First, there's one urging me to succeed, expand, and grow. The other is a persistent, ambivalent voice whispering, "Caution, go deeper, go slower." Sometimes I have to get smacked in the face a few times before my competitive juices start flowing and I say, "Okay, I'm ready for it." I'd really wanted our company to win the high-stakes competition for the MoMA contract, but now that we had it, I wondered if we'd bitten off more than we could chew. The museum had been doing everything possible to overcome all kinds of complicated last-minute construction obstacles and delays so that it could be ready for its announced reopening on November 20th, and it mandated that we be open that day too. Making matters even more challenging for us, MoMA had decided to offer free admission to the public on November 20th. There would be 20,000 people descending on the museum that day. There was no way to tell them they couldn't come to the restaurant. Ready or not, we just had to serve them. Despite having only 4 days to train our staff, we managed to get Cafe 2, our fresh take on the traditional museum cafeteria, open that day, and we served around 1,500 people there. We served another 500 hungry visitors at Terrace 5, our cafe for desserts and light fare, and 250 more guests in the barroom portion of the Modern, the only part of that restaurant which we were even remotely prepared to open on November 20th. For several nights leading up to the opening, I had uncomfortable visions of museum trustees and executives peering at us with disapproval, wondering why they had selected us and why we weren't yet on top of our game. And that was in addition to even sharper concerns about what the critics would have to say. Because the museum prohibits open flame cooking at Cafe 2 and Terrace 5, the kitchen is in the basement, and with no service elevator access to the fifth floor, our inexperienced staff members were pushing white carts full of meals and dishes up and down the public elevators, riding cheek to jowl with the throngs of museum visitors. Our new staff members brought a bright attitude to work that day, but I was concerned about whether we had done enough to prepare them for the onslaught I knew they were about to face. In just over 3 months, we had enlarged our overall USHG staff by nearly 50%, from 650 to more than 1,000 employees, and we had engineered that buildup under substandard circumstances. We'd had insufficient time for careful interviewing, hiring, and training them. In fact, we had no place to train them. Because construction delays meant that there was no certificate of occupancy for the restaurants, it wasn't until October that these spaces were even habitable. And even had we hired the staff, there was no locker room available. There was not even a staff bathroom. At one point on opening day, as I watched the snaking line of people waiting to get into Terrace 5 brush up against Henri Rousseau's masterpiece, The Dream, I had two distinct reactions that encapsulated my ecstatic anguish at achieving this day at MoMA. First, oh my God, we've just opened a restaurant with one of the art world's greatest masterpieces hanging outside the front door. Second, oh my God, the people waiting in line to eat at my restaurant are going to ruin the masterpiece and I'll be responsible. The courage to grow demands the courage to let go. Whenever you expand in business, not just the restaurant business, the process is incredibly challenging, especially for leaders who first rose to the top because of their tendency to want to control all the details. You have to let go. You have to surround yourself with ambassadors, people who know how to accomplish goals and make decisions while treating people the way you would. They're comfortable expressing themselves within the boundaries of your business culture and content with the role they play in helping a larger team achieve its greatest potential success. Opening a new restaurant can make some of your existing customers irate. Each time we've undertaken a new venture, a certain percentage of our existing customer base opts not to come along with us. Some people won't even try the new place. Some others just go once out of politeness. My first awareness of that reality was a crushing blow for me. You mean not everything we do is necessarily lovable to those who love us? But this has happened so regularly that I've had the chance to analyze what's going on. Sometimes our loyalists are unable to embrace a new restaurant, just as an older child may not fully celebrate the arrival of a newborn sibling. Customers have a natural fear that we might forget them. You can almost hear some of them saying, "Why the hell is he going into Indian food? Now he's going to the barbecue business? Is he off his rocker? What? Another one? Frozen custard? This is the end. I'm done. He doesn't love me anymore." One of the first people to express that concern to me was Paul Gottlieb, then publisher at Harry N. Abrams. Paul began eating lunch at Table 24 at Union Square Cafe in 1985 and continued to do so on more days than not for the next 18 years. He became a great friend, always providing caring feedback, and we talked frequently. His reactions were typically paternal and direct, starting with the first time I told him about my plans to open Gramercy Tavern in 1994. "You're not going to open a second restaurant," he said. "We'll never see you here again. It won't be the same." Paul, who was also a trustee of the Museum of Modern Art, expressed the same concern about my expanding 4 years later, with the opening of Tabla and 11 Madison Park. Yet, ironically, it was he who, in the early 1990s, even before Gramercy Tavern existed, had first tried to persuade me to open a restaurant at MoMA. We met at his office, and Paul spoke on behalf of the Board of Trustees. The museum then had a restaurant on its second floor called the Members' Dining Room. I had been fascinated with MoMA since I was a child. People on both sides of my family were serious collectors of modern art, and my mother had run an art gallery and was a trustee of the St. Louis Art Museum. Our kitchen calendar was always from MoMA, and our home was furnished with all kinds of products from the museum's design collection. In fact, for the first 25 years of my parents' marriage, the bond they most consistently shared, beyond their children, seemed to be their mutual affection for contemporary art. Paul's entreaty was compelling, but after two or three enticing meetings and lots of careful thought, I told him that I simply was not ready to open a second restaurant, and that if I ever did, I couldn't imagine opening one in Midtown. I lived downtown and understood how important being able to walk to all my restaurants had been as a factor in our success. Nor did it seem to make economic sense to open a restaurant in which people could eat only during museum hours. This would essentially be a lunch restaurant, and one that didn't have its own separate sidewalk entrance. Paul remained a close friend and a source of sage advice through the years. One day in mid-2001, he called and said he had something very exciting to tell me. "We're closing the museum," he confided when we met. "There's going to be a fantastic expansion and renovation unlike anything in our history." He added, "We want to put a restaurant in the new MoMA, and this time we're serious about the food. The museum is ready to discuss a standalone restaurant with its own street entrance." Recalling our discussion a decade earlier, he said, "This time around, you need to take it seriously. What you and your team could do with dining at the Museum of Modern Art could be amazing. There will definitely be others competing for this, but you must submit a proposal." That meeting was one of the last times we ever spoke. Paul died suddenly a few weeks later at the age of 67, long before those who had the honor of knowing him were prepared to say goodbye. His revelation about MoMA's historic expansion and his insistence that we be a part of it started me on a passionate pursuit whose outcome ultimately became a legacy of our long friendship. In November 2001, we had our first introductory meeting with the two senior executives at MoMA, James Guerra and Mike Marketich. We learned that the museum would reopen not just with a restaurant, but also with three cafes, two for museum visitors and another for its staff. The restaurant organization selected for this opportunity would also become the preferred caterer for museum events. We conducted several more meetings with executives, curators, and trustees over the next year. One opportunity presented itself when the museum temporarily shifted its basement film center to the Gramercy Theater on East 23rd Street off Lexington Avenue, a short walk from three of our restaurants. We created a co-marketing deal. Museum members who came to see a MoMA film received a certificate good for dessert at 11 Madison Park, Tobler, or Blue Smoke. We kept our irons in the fire until late 2002, when the museum set the deadline for receiving proposals. Serving food at MoMA seemed like a remarkable opportunity, and yet I wasn't entirely sure I really wanted us to win this thing. Having received countless pitches from real estate developers over the years, we had always had the luxury of being selective about which ones to weigh seriously. Having the tables turned and being judged by others was uncomfortable. I also had my usual nagging mixed feelings about the pace at which we were now growing and which we would continue to grow if we were to prevail. The MoMA project would transform our business by bringing us into the world of institutional dining, quick service cafes, and catering. And all the new employees it would require to staff four new dining establishments and an off-premises catering facility would make the company balloon in size. Wasn't this the kind of expansionist dreaming that my more sober-minded colleagues and relatives had always counseled against? But something unusual happened. The people in my life whom I had always counted on to ask, "What are you thinking, Danny?" were actually encouraging me. Right up until he died, Paul Gottlieb, who had groaned with dismay every time I opened another restaurant, was relentless in urging me to submit a proposal to MoMA. My mother, whose skeptical view of business growth had been colored by my father's failed expansions, was now a member of MoMA's Prints and Illustrated Books Committee, and she was tickled by the idea of our opening a restaurant there. My grandfather, Irving Harris, had been a generous lifetime supporter of MoMA. He was now in the sunset of his life, but even he urged me on. And then there was my own voice. I was increasingly confident in the capacity of the leadership team I had surrounded myself with. Most important, I trusted myself and my own motives. So the chance to create something for the Museum of Modern Art excited me. This was one venture I viewed not just as a business opportunity, but also as a tremendous privilege. When Audrey, who knew how consuming this project would be for me and for our family, said, "Of course you've got to go for this," that settled it. Conceiving the restaurant itself would no doubt be challenging, but it seemed relatively straightforward in terms of our prior experience. Tackling the two very different visitor cafes within the museum as well as the cafeteria for MoMA's staff would be a fresh challenge. And the blueprints for the museum did not indicate enough space had been allocated for a catering kitchen, so it became clear we would have to lease space and build an additional kitchen somewhere else. Funding all this would present its own steep hurdles, but the biggest question was whether we could actually juggle all those plates at the same time. If ever we were to launch a restaurant outside the familiar precinct in which we had done business for 20 years, MoMA felt like the ideal place. The museum is viewed in the world of art precisely as I dreamed our restaurants might be in the world of fine dining. It's an institution that endures and is at once forward-looking, sensibly grounded in tradition, and relevant today. Our senior management didn't go nuts trying to create the sexiest-looking presentation of all time, although we did enlist the professional support of Eric Baker, the imaginative graphic designer we had worked with on the logo for Blue Smoke, as well as many other projects. The proposal was a simple 11-page document describing our identity and why we saw ourselves as being a good fit for MoMA. Our financial offer assured MoMA that we'd have plenty of skin in the game in terms of how much of our own money we'd be investing in the build-outs, as well as what percentage of sales we would pay to the museum as rent. Our ideas for the restaurant and cafes were creative, reasoned, and sound, and as for relevant experience, that would be entirely up to MoMA to judge. During the selection process, we chose not to lobby anyone connected to MoMA, even though I was well aware that a number of regular guests at our restaurants were trustees who might be involved in the selection. If we were chosen, I wanted the choice to be based on merit. Later, there would be plenty of opportunity to compete with passion at making the restaurant, cafes, and catering operations the best they could be. We were asked to participate in a few intensive interviews with members of the museum's senior executive team. I felt fully prepared to field their questions, and the experience was exhilarating. About 90 days after we had submitted the proposal, we received a call from MoMA's chief operating officer, James Guerra. We had been chosen. Within moments, another call arrived, this one from a trustee, Bob Menschel, who was warm in his congratulations and generous in his praise. At first, the news was numbing. In a flash, I began to imagine the extraordinary amount of work that lay ahead of us, and being MoMA's choice didn't mean that we had a deal. As it turned out, 8 months of detailed work and negotiations would still remain before we would actually sign our deal in November 2003. During those 8 months, we were not permitted to announce or discuss our selection with anyone. That was tough. We batted around different rent structures for our various food businesses and established that MoMA would have control over what kinds of art could and would be displayed in our dining rooms. We determined that the museum would have approval rights over our design of the restaurants, as well as in our choice of chef and general manager. The museum's reasoning was that our dining facilities would be a representative extension of the museum experience, and that this high level of control would ensure the institution against any inappropriate or poor hiring decisions on our part. We went back and forth over real estate issues. We debated design layouts down to the inch, struggled to find adequate space for our back-of-the-house offices, debated whose phone system we would use, and agreed about which museum restrooms were available to or off-limit for our staff. Not long after signing our deal, I came up with the name of our fine dining restaurant. I remembered what my dad had taught me during the naming of Union Square Cafe. Just name it what it is. The Modern answered that challenge. I bounced the idea off trustee Ronald Lauder, who had taken a generously supportive and nearly proprietary interest in the restaurant project, and when he later expressed the board's enthusiasm for the name, the decision was made. As my team and I began to think about what we might add to the dialogue on museum dining, I asked myself, whoever wrote the rule that you can't enjoy an elegant, intimate, fine dining experience in a warm, hospitable ambience within the traditionally institutional context of a museum? And whoever wrote the rule that you can't get a warm welcome and have excellent food hospitably delivered to tables in what is traditionally a tray service museum cafeteria? In both cases, the challenge was to take what has historically been an institutional captive audience experience and make it feel warm, personal, and worthy of becoming a dining destination on its own. What was there to add to the dialogue on museum cafeterias? Well, to begin with, we acknowledged the basic reasons museum visitors patronize a cafeteria. It gets you off your feet, feeds you quickly, and charges a reasonable price. Museum cafeterias are typically designed to appeal to a very broad swath of customers: older people, younger people, Americans, foreigners, locals, tourists, students. Not being permitted to cook in the cafes due to their proximity to the art galleries would add an element of challenge. We'd have to come up with a delicious menu that could be prepared in our basement kitchen, delivered to the cafeterias, and still taste fresh and delicious. We identified two aspects of museum cafeterias we thought we could improve upon. First, most people don't really like having to carry a tray and look for a cafeteria table, especially with young kids hanging on them or while they're trying to assist an aging parent or grandparent. Second, cafeteria food, no matter how fresh it may once have been, has already been prepared and plated and has invariably been sitting out for some time in a steam table or wrapped in plastic. We realized that if we could quickly assemble fresh ingredients to order and eliminate trays and pre-packaged, pre-plated, and pre-wrapped foods, we would have something special. I remember scratching my head thinking about all the world cuisines that actually benefit from having been cooked in advance. What came to my mind most conclusively was the Roman rosticceria, one of the world's original quick service concepts, and one I had always enjoyed when I was a student in Rome. These places serve seasonal foods that have already been braised or roasted, as well as cured meats or cheeses plated to order. This kind of cooking has been done for ages in Rome, but it was a fresh approach for a museum eatery. It was a solution that suited our model perfectly, a classic culinary concept within a new framework. In the style of service that we had in mind, you would order your food from a cashier who would give you a number. Then you'd go find your own seat, and soon we'd come find you with your food. Other restaurants had successfully done this in the past, for example, the Corner Bakery in Washington, D.C., and Culver's, a frozen custard and burger specialist I had visited in St. Joseph, Michigan. I was skeptical at first, but on seeing the system work in Washington, D.C. at a Corner Bakery, I was sold. As with almost everything else we'd ever done, we were rearranging familiar existing notes to play a fresh-sounding chord. We looked at the respective roles of the three MoMA dining experiences we were creating as replenish, refresh, and restore. Cafe 2 would be for replenishing, filling your body with fuel. Terrace 5 is situated opposite the gallery in which are hung masterpieces from the museum's permanent collection: Cézanne, Seurat, Van Gogh, Picasso, Matisse, and more. Not a bad address for a restaurant. We imagine Terrace 5 as a place to refresh visitors after the fatigue that can set in after seeing so much good art. We would serve lots of things that feature the stimulating triumvirate of sugar, alcohol, and caffeine. The very location of Terrace 5 added significantly, in our view, to the dialogue on museum dining and, in fact, the whole museum experience. Being able to view Starry Night or Les Demoiselles d'Avignon after enjoying a martini, a glass of wine, or an ice cream sundae and cappuccino could allow you to see it as you've never seen it before. The modern would be for restoring. It would serve as a restaurant both for New Yorkers and for museum goers whose choice was to sit down, eat well, and also be taken care of. The modern was conceived to nurture food lovers as well as to nourish them. We were relieved when the museum agreed to select our longtime architects, Bentel and Bentel, as designers for the restaurant. Their family's deep modernist roots made them perfectly suited for the complex task, and our experience collaborating on four previous restaurants would be an important advantage in order to tackle MoMA's challenging project under a very tight timeline. Another crucially important artistic decision for this project was selecting the chef for the Modern. I wanted the Modern to become a critically acclaimed destination restaurant, not just an excellent version of a museum restaurant. My initial thought was to find one chef for the restaurant and another to oversee the cafes and catering. By dividing these duties, I believed we'd have a better chance at excelling in all areas. I ran through my own mental Rolodex of many prospective chefs, most of whom, on reflection, would have been completely wrong. When I thought about someone who was cooking primarily Italian, it didn't make sense. If I thought about someone who was cooking with Southwestern flavors, it felt odd. This was not the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum, after all. So did anything else ethnic, such as Indian, Asian, Chinese, or Japanese. The modernist art movement was rooted primarily in Austria, Switzerland, Germany, and France. Not only would the new restaurant be taking its design cues from the museum's existing architecture and from modernism, it would also be looking out onto the Abbey Aldrich Rockefeller Sculpture Garden, with famous works by the artists Jean Miró, Henry Moore, Pablo Picasso, Ellsworth Kelly, Joel Shapiro, Gaston Lachaise, and Alberto Giacometti. If that was going to be the elegant backdrop for our restaurant, then our cooking had better present an entirely consistent foreground. At one point, I made a list of 30 prospective chefs, and many others called me to throw their toques into the ring. One leading contender took himself out of the running when the very complicated scope of the project became apparent to him. Indeed, the reality of this complexity was catching up with me. The clock was suddenly ticking down to 365 days for an opening in November 2004, and we needed to hire a chef to get up and running by then, as well as to overcome major issues of design and construction that were suddenly no longer a matter of what if, they had become real. On New Year's Day 2004, I was at a party in the home of Dorothy and Doug Hamilton, founders of the French Culinary Institute, the most prominent culinary trade school in New York, when I ran into the school's dean, the esteemed French chef Alain Sayac. I described my vision for the Modern and asked Chef Sayac whom he thought I should hire. Immediately, he suggested a dynamic young chef named Gabriel Kreuter. Why hadn't I thought of that? I had enjoyed Gabriel's cooking at Atelier, a French restaurant at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Manhattan, where he had served as executive chef following several years at Jean Georges. Gabriel was from the province of Alsace in the northeast corner of France, and what I knew of his cooking style, forward, personal, classic, spare, and soulful, seemed completely compatible with a modernist setting. Gabriel was still in his mid-30s, but had already cooked at some of the best restaurants in New York. That year, Food and Wine named him one of the top 10 best new chefs in America. The fit felt very right. Over the course of several months, Gabrielle and I proceeded to discuss the project and visit the construction site. We got to know one another before I made an offer, which Gabrielle at last accepted. In mid-2003, I'd heard that Anna Marie Mormando, the longtime director of operations for Jean-Georges Van Gerichten's restaurants, was herself considering a career change. I'd agreed to interview her even though we didn't have any specific job opening for her. We hadn't yet gotten the go-ahead for MoMA, and it hadn't dawned on me whom we'd put in charge of our museum operations if we were to take on the project. In our first meeting, I learned that Anna Marie had run an earlier incarnation of the members' dining room at MoMA, and that she had experience operating restaurants at Lincoln Center. The lights went on. We brought her aboard for a full year before opening at MoMA, during which time she was responsible for our construction and our opening timeline. We also wanted her to get a flavor for and become an established part of our Union Square Hospitality Group culture. Anna Marie led a talented team of over 300 staff members to open our dining facilities at MoMA, with little time, scant practice, and unrelenting pressure. And this was all without a general manager for the Modern, since the GM we hired at the outset had resigned about a week before the restaurant opened, acknowledging a mutual mistake. He was someone about whom we had heard wonderful things, but who unfortunately was just not the right fit to open this restaurant in this setting and under this amount of pressure. In the final days leading up to our opening, as it became clear that we were on a collision course with November 20th, I remember saying something to the museum executives that was not especially appreciated. "Unlike a piece of art," I said, "restaurants are not inanimate objects. You can't simply hang them on a wall by a set date and expect them to work or even look good. They need to be trained, fine-tuned, focused, recalibrated." It was my emotional way of trying to bring reality to bear on the near impossibility of our mandate to hire and train so many people in a rushed, high-pressure situation. Reluctantly, the museum agreed to allow us to push back the opening of the barroom to the general public until January 2005. On February 7th, we at last opened our doors to the public for dinner in the dining room of the Modern. And just one night later, on February 8th, the New York Times' restaurant critic Frank Bruni paid the restaurant a visit. Unbeknownst to us, Mr. Bruni was also dining at one of our other restaurants, 11 Madison Park. His 2-star review of the restaurant on February 23rd caught the staff by surprise and resulted in a demoralized team. We had never known what he looked like. The custom for food critics is to be anonymous whenever that's possible, even if it means dining in disguise. But the first time he came to the Modern, a champagne salesman who happened to be at the bar pointed to a dark-haired man at a table and said to one of our bartenders, "That's Frank Bruni over there." By our best count, the reviewer paid us 11 separate visits in total before he had at last gathered enough information to write his review. At the very least, his visits alone had generated significant revenue for the restaurants. I have never opened a restaurant where the members of the staff were as keyed up and uptight about a review as everyone at the Modern was in anticipation of this one. Managers, cooks, and servers were so concerned about how well or poorly we would fare that many of them stopped acting naturally. The morning after one of Bruni's visits, at the end of March 2005, I was on a spring vacation with my family at the Colony Beach and Tennis Resort in Longboat Key, Florida, when I got a call just as I was leaving the tennis court. It was Anna Marie phoning to say that something terrible had happened the previous night. One of our wine captains had gone up to the critic as he was retrieving his coat at the end of the meal and told him how grateful she was that he had just given a glowing 2-star review to her friend's restaurant, Stone Park Cafe, a small place in Brooklyn. Some members of our staff were beside themselves because our wine captain had broken a ludicrous cardinal rule. Even if you know who a critic is, you gotta play the game of pretending that you don't know. This wine captain, therefore, had acted unprofessionally, Anna Marie said. What should we do? I had to laugh. It would be unnatural behavior not to extend especially warm hospitality to someone who has returned to the restaurant even 3 or 4 times, never mind 11. That wine captain had been expressing hospitalitarian soul, and soul was what seemed to me to be missing from the Modern in those early days. We were quickly becoming technically proficient. In fact, knowing that we were on such a big, brightly lit stage, with all those trustees, foodies, journalists, regulars from our other restaurants, and museum visitors watching us at close range, I had reversed my usual strategy and focused on hiring more 49%ers with their seasoned technical skills. But the staff was stiff and so psyched out by the perceived pressure to be perfect that our service wasn't nearly as warm and hospitable as our standards required, or as our guests expected it to be. The fact that incidents like this one were being blown out of proportion made me realize just how uptight everyone was. Did anyone truly believe that a genuine expression of gratitude would have any downward influence on the number of stars we would receive from the New York Times? Would a restaurant critic lower his judgment of the restaurant or its food because someone had actually been nice? 11 visits were a lot of experiences to arrive at the conclusion that the Modern was a 2-star restaurant, as Bruni did in May 2005. I've always wished that restaurant critics would be more like wine critics. They taste wines that are very young and predict the future. This is where the wine is going. It will be a classic someday. I don't think Bruni would have betrayed his readers nor damaged his reputation if he had written, "This restaurant is on a fast trajectory to become a 3-star restaurant." We didn't conceive or design the Modern to be very good. It was born to be excellent. And in its first year, the restaurant was judged so by the Financial Times the International Herald Tribune, Newsweek, Esquire, which made it the best new restaurant in the United States, Wallpaper Magazine, which named it the best new restaurant in the world, Time Out New York, best new restaurant in New York. The James Beard Foundation called it the best new restaurant in America, and even the 2006 Michelin Guide to New York City, which gave the Modern one star just after its opening. In some ways, Bruni's review was a turning point for the restaurant. It at last liberated the senior management team from the stress of waiting and wondering, and it encouraged them to roll up their sleeves and begin to have some fun. It took the hot lid off a highly pressurized boiler. I even think the food improved soon after the review because Gabrielle had been playing it safe in anticipation of the piece. The waiters loosened up and began smiling and looking people in the eye, and they too improved. Everyone had been playing not to lose as opposed to playing to win. Now the staff was finding it enjoyable for the first time to exceed expectations. "You mean to tell me this is only a 2-star restaurant?" people would say. "You guys are better than that." In fact, I too felt free. I was, for the first time in my career of opening restaurants, feeling relaxed. This project was so huge and so far beyond any fantasies I may have had about actually being in control that it forced me to let go. It made me do what I've always known I needed to do, surround myself with incredibly talented people, give them clear direction, goals, and feedback, and not try to be everywhere at once. Well, except for the first 3 or 4 months when I made 2 trips each day to the museum to go on my rounds, collect and connect the new dots, and check in on everything. Before we opened the Modern, I'm not sure there had ever been a museum restaurant in America that was a destination in and of itself. The museum restaurants we knew of had been designed as amenities for attendees. They were meant more to serve a captive audience than to be competitive standalone eateries. We knew we'd have something unique if we could create a restaurant that you'd want to go to even if it did not look out onto one of the world's most spectacular sculpture gardens. You can spend many years in the restaurant business trying to attract and earn the loyalty of a regular core clientele. At the Modern, we basically had a built-in club, the museum, its trustees, its curators, and its executives. That was both a wonderful privilege and a high-class challenge as we worked to build a new community of friends. Since the Modern is the first restaurant at MoMA that has also been open to the non-museum-going public, we'd presented ourselves with another new challenge. How do we operate on one hand as an exclusive club and, on the other hand, as a public restaurant? Learning to do this was quite tricky at the outset. People who were used to hearing yes were instead getting incessant busy signals only to finally get through and hear, "I'm sorry, we're booked." We were trying hard to balance the needs of several constituencies, each entitled to the utmost in hospitality: the MoMA community, the legion of loyalists from our existing restaurants, our investors, and, of course, the thousands of curious New Yorkers who line up to be among the first to visit a new restaurant. One day I stood in the Modern and observed a trustee of the museum sitting next to a high-powered financier. A couple of tables away were some art-loving tourists from Minneapolis, and dining not too far from their table was the alternative singer Bjork, who was sitting next to a well-known book editor. It's a richly diverse clientele, and one that's unpredictable in the most positive way each day. Making my dining room rounds is every bit as exciting at the Modern as it was when I began doing it at Union Square Cafe in 1985. I can't wait to go there. Like all of our restaurants, the Modern will take time to fulfill its greatest potential, but I'm confident it will become a great and enduring New York restaurant. That will have happened when it develops its own soul through the same process of conducting a dialogue with its guests that each of the other restaurants has gone through for a sustained period of time. MoMA provides the perfect frame for the Modern. It's a peak career opportunity for my company and for me. When the Museum of Modern Art buys a piece of art to hang on its walls, that artist's career is instantly affirmed. When MoMA selects a chair or a watch for its design collection, the esteem in which that product is held grows instantly and dramatically. I have to hope that the same has happened for us. The Museum of Modern Art is an established arbiter of taste, design, and art, and creating a living product for such an institution is something I could hardly have dreamed of as a restaurateur. Soon after we embarked on our deal with MoMA, Glenn Lowry, who is the museum's director and a highly effective CEO, offered me some heartfelt advice. "Please don't get caught up in the aura of the museum," he said. "We selected you because of what we know of you. Too often people try too hard with us and end up not doing their best work." I heard his advice, but for me it was impossible not to try hard when I was part of creating a restaurant whose 35-foot windows overlook the Abby Aldrich Rockefeller Sculpture Garden. Why do I keep climbing mountains? Because, with few exceptions, there's always a higher, steeper mountain to scale, and I'm willing to confront all sorts of treacherous conditions, especially when I'm convinced that they'll lead to exhilarating views from the top. It's the same with opening new restaurants and with any new business initiative. The MoMA project was a massive challenge for our organization. I wish I could think of an even bigger word to describe it. As with each new business I've ever opened, I'm profoundly confident that this story will have a happy ending. Lacking a crystal ball, I have no idea how many or what kind of episodes and temporary setbacks there will be along the way, or what shape they'll take. However, we'll have no choice but to improve and persevere with each step we take up the mountain. I'm now growing excited about seeing our organization take on another new challenge, to expand one of our existing businesses. Replicating something that we're already doing will demand a new set of skills and will represent a wonderful opportunity for me to stretch as a professional and for the organization to stretch as well. Whenever we do it, our challenge will be to do so in a way that conveys excellence, hospitality, and soul. And, of course, wherever we do it, the timing and context will have to be a neat fit. That's precisely how we're addressing the challenge of off-premises catering. We launched Hudson Yards Catering in late 2005 and named it, as we like to do, for the emerging neighborhood in which the commissary is located. Through a persistent search, our team found a spot that was affordable and in Manhattan, overlooking the Hudson River in the West 20s. Just as we've done with our other businesses, connecting our catering company with its community reflects our broader long-range interest in becoming an active stakeholder in the revitalization of an emerging part of the city. We will also take the same approach to the catering business that has worked so well for every other business we've tackled. We'll apply the strategy of enlightened hospitality while challenging ourselves to find a way to add something fresh to the experience of off-premises catering. And we'll always look for unique ways and places for Hudson Yards Catering to serve its food. On a Monday afternoon in May 2005, I came home unusually early, around 4:30, to don my tuxedo and get ready for the evening's event, the James Beard Foundation Awards. Getting home so early was so unusual that my then 5-year-old son Peyton tore himself away from his playdate and ran down the hall to bear witness. "Daddy's home before dinner!" We hung out while I struggled, as I always do, with my tuxedo. "You look like Mr. Davison," he said, pointing to my bow tie. That's the headmaster at his school. "Are you going to school tonight?" "No," I said, "I'm actually going to an awards event." "What's an award?" "That's a kind of prize you can get if people think you did something really well." "Well, Daddy, are you going to get one of those tonight?" "I don't know. They're giving out prizes for people who do a good job at being in the restaurant business." "Well," he said, "I think you should get that prize. I think Shake Shack is the best restaurant in the world. I love their frozen custard." That joyous moment with my son was the most meaningful thing that happened to me all night. The second most meaningful was winning the first ever James Beard Award for Outstanding Restaurateur in a national field of impressive colleagues. I proudly accepted it on behalf of our entire organization. It was clear to me that we weren't really winning for being the best at any one specific cuisine or concept. The reason had more to do with our stretching the contours and the applicability of our hospitality-driven business model, from Union Square to Gramercy Park to Madison Square Park to 27th Street and up Fifth Avenue to the Museum of Modern Art. We won it because whether you order a Shack burger and a frozen custard at Shake Shack, or a lamb tenderloin carpaccio with black truffles at the Modern, whether you're eating on paper plates or dining on Limoges China, there's plenty on the table we've set to nourish and nurture you. Our job and our joy is to create restaurants you'd want to return to, and to build businesses that ultimately contribute at least as much for their communities as they reap from them. For over two decades, we've worked hard to create a broad community of people who have a real stake in our restaurant's success. And because we have first committed our loyalty to them, they've paid us back abundantly. When people choose to become regulars at Union Square Cafe or Gramercy Tavern or 11 Madison Park or Tabla or Blue Smoke or Jazz Standard or The Modern or our museum cafes or at Shake Shack or Hudson Yards Catering, they're telling us, this is the place that most makes me feel I've come home.
We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.